Hello and welcome to Liberty Southwest podcast number not 26, but 36. Today is the 8th of December 2014. We're going to be discussing the national debt, which recently eclipsed $18 trillion. Tonight I am joined by Eric Taylor, Kirk Pettis, and Chelsea Cuomo. I am Matt Winter, and we have got a fantastic clip from my friend Eric Taylor.
So we're talking about the national debt, which has recently crossed $18 trillion. And I have a clip that kind of breaks it down, and basically the gist of it is that even though we're at an $18 trillion figure, when you look at the grand scheme of things, it's not as bad as you might have heard. Now, there's concern about, how the United States is going to take care of this debt. But really what this clip illustrates is that most of the debt that's been monetized has actually been bought by various government agencies. But before we go into that, this is really the idea for the podcast was brought up by Kirk. And I don't know if you don't have anything else to say, we can roll into the clip, or if you have some thoughts before then, you're more than welcome to chime in.
Well, for one, since Obama pretty much came to office, I think that the debt ceiling's been raised like six times in the first like 4 years of his term. And has the debt ceiling been raised lately? I don't remember. I've never seen what – I guess I should have looked it up earlier, but
– March of last year.
That's kind of off the table is what it seems like lately. Like it's just being ignored or it's just instantly done without even debate these days, unless it's going to be done during election time, put up some divisive measures. But, yeah, it's just people – it should – I think it's pretty much news to everyone that hears that it's $18 trillion that doesn't follow the news system. And the media, I don't think, was reporting it. So it's the debt's doubled in the last 9 years and just pretty – it's just growing and it's going to start exponentially growing too. So it's going to be interesting. And I don't know. We just don't see the PR or propaganda for or against it lately. It's just kind of just – being ignored, and I don't know, $18 trillion is a milestone, and that would be fun to talk about.
All right, I'll play the clip. If you want to interject, stop, just let me know, and I'll stop it here, 6.5 minutes.
Good morning, Hank. It's Tuesday. So one of the biggest issues in global politics these days is government debt and deficits, which is a particularly big deal in the United States because of the presidential campaign and also because...
I should add, this clip is a couple years old, but it's still applicable.
Because of the looming fiscal cliff. And Hank, as you'll no doubt remember, I received a bronze medal in economics at the 1994 Alabama State Academic Decathlon, meaning that in 1994, I was the third best 17-year-old economist among all C students in the state of Alabama. So not to brag or anything, but I'm pretty qualified to explain this stuff. Okay, so first we have to separate the ideas of debt and deficit. Debt is the total amount of our outstanding liabilities. Deficit, or occasionally surplus, is the difference between what the government spends and what it takes in. Right, so in the United States, our current national debt is around $16 trillion, which sounds like a lot of money, and it is. But let's break this down. The largest single holder of U.S. government debt is actually the federal government itself, because trust funds like Social Security buy government bonds, and so the interest goes from the U.S. government to a different part of the U.S. government, which is not borrowing as we usually imagine it. So if you take away that money, you're left with about $11 trillion, which is still a fair bit of cash. Who owns that debt? China, you probably guessed. But in fact, no. The plurality of that debt is actually owned by us being American individuals and institutions. China owns about 8% of our debt, Japan 7%, and the U.K. 1%. But it's important to note that the U.S. also owns foreign debt, including about $235 billion of sovereign debt in China and Hong Kong. Altogether, for every $1 of U.S. debt that's owned by a foreign country, we own about 89 cents of foreign debt. So
I think that's pretty important. I think a lot of people believe that China owns a substantial amount of U.S. debt, but when you really look at it, it's quite low. And I think among various pundits,
what did they say is about 10%?
8%.
8%, yeah. And then Japan's like 7%.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they're pretty close to together.
Yeah.
And what I find amazing is that the UK only has 1% for debt.
Right. So, I mean, I think a lot of people, you know, especially if you're, you remember some political campaigns from a couple of years ago, you know, the impression was really made that China owned a vast majority of the United States debt, which really isn't the case. I'll go ahead and roll it more here.
Can't really think of government debt the same way you'd think about like a family owing money to a credit card company, because in that situation, the family owes money to someone else. But in the case of U.S. government debt, we mostly indirectly or directly owe money to ourselves. So our national debt is a very large number, but at least at the moment, it is not a very large problem. Like in 2011, we paid about 3% total interest on our debt. In 2012, it will be even less because our debt is incredibly cheap right now. I mean, Hank, in some ways, it is literally cheaper than free. Right now, the yield on a one-year treasury bond is 0.17%. Okay, two very important things to note about the debt. First, China can't, like, call in our debt on a day of its choosing. If I buy a $100 one-year treasury bond today, I'm gonna get that $100 back along with my 17 cents in interest in 1 year. I can't call after a month and be like, give me my money back. So despite what you hear from a lot of political commentators, that is not really a risk to the US economy. Secondly, you may have heard people say the government should be run like a business. It should never spend more than it takes in. Yeah, no, that is not how businesses are run. Like, say that tomorrow I invent a Marty McFly hovercraft skateboard. In that situation, I wouldn't wait 20 years until I'd sold enough DFTBA posters to build my Marty McFly hoverboard factory. I would just borrow the money and build the factory immediately so I could start selling hoverboards and swim in a sea of $100 bills. Actually, I would not swim in a sea of $100 bills. I would hoverboard over that sea. Businesses spend more than they bring in all the time. As well they should, and almost all economists agree that governments are similar. There are times when they need to run deficits. For instance, during a recession, government revenue goes down because wages stagnate and unemployment goes up, but government expenditures have to go up, like on unemployment benefits, for instance. So just to be clear, deficits are not inherently evil, and our current debt, while it is very large, does not pose a threat to the American economy because we can pay it back with relative ease.
Do any of you guys have thoughts on that? Because that's been, you know, that's, you know, been a concern amongst various individuals that it's so large that, you know, how do you pay that back?
It's never intended
to
be paid back.
The really important part is understanding the difference between, you know, our gross debt and the amount of that debt that's public debt. You know, and that's something, like, whenever I hear about, you know, the debt of the United States, I was kind of led to believe by the major media sources that China owns, like, some enormous amount, essentially, like, of our country, you know, like, that they own so much debt that, you know, any day they could start enforcing or really using, a lot of clout to push us around. That's kind of the way that it was framed, the way that I heard it, but, if the majority of our debt is public, God, I mean, on consolidated financial statements of the, you know, whatever organization it is to the other, those all net to zero, essentially. I mean, so.
Not necessarily. Yeah.
No, well, it's pretty close to zero because of the fact that interest rates are so low, specifically on one-year treasuries, and other treasuries. Servicing of the debt is extremely, extremely cheap for the U.S.
Well, it's lower than inflation.
It's much lower. Yeah.
Well, they took all the Social Security cash and then put it into bonds to buy the government bonds. So it's the government spending the money before they even, and then they have that unfunded liability. That's why our unfunded liability is $100 trillion. So it's not really zero.
No, I don't think that you're understanding what I'm saying. So, like,
I am because it's treasury.
Like, debt held by the public is reported as a liability, you know. But understanding that if it's a liability to the treasury, when you consolidate those financial statements, you're going to have an asset on one side and a liability on the other side, but in equal amounts, which net to zero. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, but the assets already been spent.
So assets are a total, like.
They took the money and invested it amongst their own government in another form, and then they're going to get interest from it. It's the bonus. But if you took Social Security and did it privatization-wise, that investment would have a far greater return than the interest that you're going to get from the government through the bond system. And so it's – and we have to come up with that money eventually. So it's we're going to – it doesn't make sense because of how that money is going to come due and need to be spent, and we're not even bringing enough revenue to pay the government expenses in any given year today. So how would we ever even get more money to pay off that liability?
I think we'll
– That's a great question. Money,
or else just print it or inflate your way out.
Well, I'm sorry, Eric, what were you going to say?
I think as we go on with this clip, that point will be somewhat addressed and explained.
I mean, it's not going to be free, but it's going to be like 2% of GDP. We've done it before. However, there is a huge future risk to us, because what if our debt stopped being cheap? What if people stop believing that the U.S. is the safest place to put their money, and they start to buy bonds in, I don't know, like Brazil or China or Germany? Well, that would be very bad, because most years we run a budget deficit, and so we would need to keep borrowing money at these higher interest rates, which would necessitate more deficits and therefore more borrowing at progressively higher interest rates. And then we'd have to cut spending, which would slow growth, and raise taxes, which would slow growth more, and then Greece. Except this might actually be much worse for us than it's been for Greece, because the U.S. enjoys all kinds of benefits from having the world's most trusted currency. Like, Hank, believe it or not, most U.S. paper currency actually circulates outside the U.S., and that's very helpful for us in terms of exchange rates and keeping our debt cheap. And if we lost that, it would be devastating, because we would just be a regular country again. Okay, so the federal deficit in 2011 was about 1.3 trillion. It'll be down a little bit this year to about a trillion. It'll be down further in 2013, no matter who is president, to about 900 billion. But most people think that number needs to continue to come down, or at some point we are going to risk these spiraling higher interest rates. So there are two ways of doing this. The first is to print more money, like, oh, we need $100 billion to close the deficit. Look, I just made $100 billion using a printing press. That sounds like a fine idea, except that it will lead to inflation. Now, a lot of people in comments will be saying that we should just return to the gold standard, which I think is a very bad idea for the reasons I explained in the doobly-doo. However, in the broadest sense, our currency is already pegged to goods and services, because if the amount of money in the world doubled tomorrow, the amount of stuff wouldn't. So you can imagine what would happen to the cost of everything. It would double. The second and better way to cut the deficit is to close the gap between what we take in and what we spend. And in times of economic expansion, this is actually quite easy, because the tax base grows and the amount of money people make goes up, so they pay more taxes, so we can just have surpluses, as we did in the 1990s. But during slow recoveries, like the one we have right now, it is much more complicated. So like both President Obama and Governor Romney favored unspecified spending cuts, Governor Romney also favors a tax cut of 20% across the board, whereas President Obama thinks that we should increase taxes by rolling back the Bush-era tax cut on income over $250,000. Neither of these plans is likely to eliminate the deficit, although again, the deficit doesn't necessarily need to be eliminated, and no matter what political rhetoric you hear, neither of these plans is terribly radical either. President Obama wants to put the top marginal income tax rate at 39%. It was over 50% every year from 1945 until 1986. Mitt Romney wants to cut that tax rate to 28.5%, which is where it was in 1989. We can argue thoughtfully about what our policy position should be, but amid all the rhetoric and decontextualized statistics, I just want to underscore that while deficit reduction is important, it is not a crisis. The whole idea here is to keep it from becoming a crisis, and one of the best ways to do that is to understand the problem without yelling about it, to discuss things honestly without assuming that the people who disagree with you hate America. Mm. Hank, see you Friday.
That was awesome.
Yes.
So, like, okay, so I don't know if I should jump into this right now, but, I mean, over the past few, you know, episodes, I've really been thinking about how we're seeing movements of the people and by the people, just, you know, people acting as individuals in their self-interest of what they truly believe is right, and then that, you know, a bunch of individuals then collectively starting this, you know, movement. And I was talking with a friend of mine earlier, and we were talking about, well, what if, you know, we started to really recognize and, you know, appreciate, you know, the amount of power that we, the people, really do have. I mean, if you think about how massive our government is, And maybe this is debatable, but even at this point in time, we wouldn't say that the government totally controls us, right? Like, we still have faith that there's an opportunity for freedom and liberty, which is why I assume we're all here tonight, you know, that we still have faith that even as big and monstrous as our government is, that we still believe that we the people have power. So if we can say that, think about how much power we the people do have. So rather than, like, asking everything of our government, what if we just, like, stopped creating the demand, and maybe that would reduce the supply? Like, if we stopped asking the government to solve things for us, then started solving them ourselves, then they wouldn't have as many jobs to do, would they? And they wouldn't require as much money or as much power as they have, because that need isn't there.
I don't see that happening. I mean, I guess we could go look at Greece, see if their government went down or if it increased.
Oh, fuck that. No, let's just talk about, like, the U.S. Let's talk about what would happen.
There's no better example than other governments that this happens to.
Greece is an outlier. They were taking advantage of cheap debt in Europe and basically living off prosperous northern countries, Scandinavian countries in Europe. And their debt was called in the Czech. The United States is the most productive, you know, per capita producer of goods and services in the world. So it's an apples and oranges type of comparison, in my opinion. And, you know, as far as what Chelsea's talking about, I think that's a trend that probably there's a really good chance that type of philosophy will take deeper and deeper root. Because when you talk about younger generations, they're apolitical. You know, like there's a high desire to live through voluntarism and cooperative philosophies much more so than past generations. When you talk about the United States, there's a social trend or change that's in place that could certainly challenge the more traditional system of debt that the government has embraced in the past. So I don't think that's something that's out of the realm of possibility at all.
Well, it's exciting. I mean, we're seeing we're seeing these huge changes, like as we talked about, like, for example, like in Colorado or Washington, where when they legalized marijuana, that didn't come from us asking the government, like, if it was okay. It came from people putting forth referendums. Like, so we're saying we, the people, are going to talk about this and decide on what we want. We're not going to ask the government what's okay, because the government is here to serve the people, and as the people, we can figure this out ourselves.
It's essentially nullification, at a state level, what's happened. If you want to talk specifically about...
the best part was Arizona saying to nullify any federal law if they want to.
Right. And that's not what Chelsea was specifically referencing, but that's another example where there is a localized, grassroots movement that's spreading, where, you know, we can, from a local level, we can manage, our affairs better, you know, than a federalist type of, view, right?
Right.
But see,
what we talked about last week with, the permaculture, how they talked about how it was much more successful when individuals created their lives around, you know, what they're trying to achieve, and they created or embraced some of these, you know, techniques and theories of permaculture, and that might be a little different than how their neighbor does it or somebody does it across the country or in another state. So you can really tailor it and specify it to your needs. And so then you have all of these little individual, you know, pockets. instead of one large, you know, black and white, unmoving, unflexing machine, you're getting something that best suits the needs of all the people that are involved. And it's okay that they vary a little bit. And then we can learn from people who are really successful, and we can learn from the people who've made mistakes. And it's more organic, it's more lifelike, and it's just, it allows it to grow and change as we grow and change.
So what you're saying is we're returning to the mindset of what this country was founded upon, because that's what everyone thought back then, and we've just had this mindset of all every government's the solution, and that's what has been promoted for the last century. And so now it's come to a head to where people are waking up through, you know, technology like the internet and learning more and knowing that they're not alone in this thinking and finding other groups to be a part of. And
I would agree with that.
It's
I
nothing
think that,
new.
Well, it's nothing
no, it's
new,
not new,
but the ability
it's a new
to
way.
The ability to communicate and congregate around around you know various ideas like that is now, I mean, that's available, which is that is new.
Which is
newer.
Which is okay. Yeah. So forgive me if this, I was thinking about this earlier. So back in the day, we used to have like communities, or if you go back further into many different cultures, we had tribes, right? And there was actually in a Malcolm Gladwell book I read, I forget which one it was, where they talked about how we can only truly like emotionally connect with and be intimate with like about like 150 people, and only truly be concerned about like 150 people's well-being on like a person-to-person basis. And that's why communities and tribes were so natural at, you know, during, you know, the human evolution of different societies. And during the industrial era, it's almost like we lost that for a minute. Like we saw the community and the tribe really like disappear and fall to the wayside to the history books. But now, like with technology, it's almost as though we're finding like a new platform to reconnect with a community. And that's where you're starting to see these movements of people being bound not by proximity, but by ideology and by value and belief and interest. And that's where people are starting to come together again. I don't know. Do you see that?
No, I do. Yeah, and that's I think that's a huge positive. And you know, when you're talking about getting away from what we're referencing here is government and debt. There's really, you know, where you see government debt manifest from is from politicians trying to give their citizens or their voters goodies, essentially, to get themselves elected. Yeah. I mean, that's where you get that. That's really one of the main reasons for debt. And so, if you're a congressman in your district, you're a senator in your district, or et cetera, you want to bring home the goodies to get elected, and you're not really accountable for that. But as you have communities that develop. Through various means, you understand that you don't necessarily need government to provide those goods and services. You can provide that type of functionality much more cost. You know, it can be provided in a much more cost-effective, more productive way by working with other individuals within your community, right?
I agree, absolutely. You know, because when you have this like this huge machine, like Social Security or, you know, the FDA or the this or the that, you know, it becomes so rigid because you have to in order to try and maximize the efficiency of a very large machine. You have to make things, like you have to have a standard operating procedure, and it cannot vary, and it has to be black and white. And so then you need another layer of administration and another layer of administration. When you have things on a localized level, you're providing needs based on the actual need, not on, you know, as much projections or estimations, but more like, this is what this community needs. And those needs aren't stagnant, they change, you know, and they grow and they shrink in different areas. So it doesn't really, it makes sense why we're seeing the inefficiencies and the shortcomings of the government as it tries to provide the goodies, you know, not to mention that when you have something that's that large, it's going to inherently become, you know, with power comes the corruption, right? So then we also have the corruption costs. Whereas if you have a very spread out, decentralized power structure, there's not as many people grabbing for the goodies, which reduces the cost. Does that seem like a fair assessment?
To me, it does. I don't know. Kirk, what do you think?
I just think it's absolutely outrageous that people think that those goodies are available to get. And that, I, you know, it's just government's growing into what can you do for me, instead of what one of the famous quotes of JFK was, you know, don't ask what you can do for not what the government can do for you, but what you can do for the government.
Well, and not just like for the government, but for the country, you know, for your fellow people, you know. So, like, to be honest, I don't really give a shit about what I could give to the government. I'm more concerned about what we can do for us, what we can do for us as a people, you know, what we can do for the world. I mean, because, I mean, how
well,
can
the
we best
way
best
to do is to
do?
Not be in debt. That's the ideal number one.
Yeah, except your credit score gets screwed over unless you participate in the whole debt and credit game. Is pretty screwed up, if you ask me.
Well, that's just wanting to be part of the game, then.
Who wants to be part of the game? I don't.
Oh.
But, you know, then you have to, like, balance that with, do I really want to have credit cards and debt? Or...
Well, it's being responsible. That's why you get a good credit score, is being responsible with the debt you accumulate, and you can pay it off right away. So
yeah,
it's,
but, like, it pushes us into debt. Like, it's become the American way.
How does it push you into debt if you pay it off?
With the American way. But it pushes you to play into the system. Like, I want to pay for things as I can afford them. Like, my car. I didn't take a loan out on it. I, like, saved money. Like, I knew my car was getting old, and so I, like, put money away, and I put money away and waited until I could afford one, and then I bought one. Like, I didn't buy a new car. I didn't buy a fancy car, but, like, I bought one without financing it, and I like doing that. But guess how many credit points I got for it? None. That's how many. Even though I did the absolutely most responsible thing that I could possibly do, I got no credit.
Yeah, well, that's because you weren't dealing in credit. You're not dealing in credit.
But the whole point is that I'm financially responsible, and I should get credit for that.
Well, no, you shouldn't. That's not how the formulas are worked for it.
Why do you think that is? I mean,
because that's how the system's set up. You have to be a part of it.
You could totally do a lone wolf on me if you want to, but I think our systems are set up to entice us to become indebted.
Yes, they are. They want us in debt. But that's why I said earlier, it's not only the fault of the government. It's the fault of people in general that feel like they have to have a home, that they have to have a car. That whatever, and we just have this mentality of just get it now, and that's what's promoted our economy to be the number one in the world, but it comes with its costs.
But don't you think?
And
that
our government is
credit system is built to entice people into debt instead of us as a country promoting each other's financial well-being. Instead, we have systems in place that promote. Financial irresponsibility and
well, this system isn't set up for a greater good. It's a system set up as a business. These are financial conglomerates systems that have set up, and that's how they make their money. And so, if you want to be a part of that system, you got to be a part of their game, and you got to be responsible. Not everyone's responsible, and they end up paying the price by having to pay more down the road. But
how do we apply this then to the government? So, like, with the national debt. Kirk, if you could do something today, like anything that you wanted, and you had total government approval, what would you do to, like, solve this?
I don't think it's solvable.
You don't think
it's not meant to be solvable.
What's the point of like talking about something if there's no hope anymore? We can just say, "Oh, well, that sucks. Moving on."
Like, it shows the fallacy of a fiat currency and how through the systems of the central banks and how the world is setting up through central banks throughout the entire world and supporting each other. It's essentially why all of our government and all the other governments give each other money. And so that's why this whole debt thing, it's more of a political ploy and tool to argue about during come election times. And you can't lower the debt. It's just not feasibly possible.
Oh, I disagree with you. I do.
It's ingrained into the system, and that's why it's different between the public and private debt. But it does have its ramifications, and it all boils down to our goodwill of the people of the globe and utilizing the American dollar and still holding it up high, but that's about to change. And us as Americans, that we've been going down this road with our heads in the sand, ignoring these issues of our government spending twice as much as they take in.
Let's talk positive, though. I mean, instead of focusing on what all the problems are, let's talk about solutions here. Like, I really believe that there
are
solutions.
You've got to know the problem, though, to solve it.
You can talk about the road that we're going down, but that doesn't mean that we're at the end yet.
That is created on that's necessary to keep expanding.
So how does that change?
Through an awakening of public, realizing that we can't have everything go funnels through government, and then not fear terrorists in the world that live in caves on the other side of the world, and not send our government war machine throughout the world and send up dictators in the other world enslaving their own citizens for our general interests. And we've become a huge bully form of government through our selfishness as Americans and through our reluctance to face the problems that we create in the world. And it's going to come back and haunt us down the road.
But you're saying that as though you haven't just listed off many things that could possibly be solutions. Like, that's what I'm saying. Instead of focusing on, we're inevitably fucked. Instead, we could just say, you know what? We're not going in a right direction, but we can turn this ship around. Like, and it doesn't take pointing fingers, and it doesn't take blaming someone else. It takes standing up as an individual and saying, I'm going to act differently. And I hope that there are people out there that will join me.
And there are individuals who are and who have stated that, where, the basic argument is interventionalism does not produce any positive effect and oversee conflicts or disagreements. And, maybe that it doesn't, to me, seem like that's something that's been broadly observed and agreed upon. But you never know, given enough time. I think there's an axiom where I've heard this before that generally the citizens get the government that they deserve. They vote in the politicians that they deserve. And, eventually if there's a subset of the population that's informed enough, to say, you know what, interventionalism doesn't provide the needed benefit that maybe some of the political state you get, that maybe those things change, and it's happened in the past, and there's no reason to believe why that type of result can't happen going forward, right?
I agree.
Well, to go back to what you asked Chelsea earlier, what would I do? I would say allow yourself to be removed from government, essentially. That you are no longer a citizen. That you are a product of the world, and you can do what you want to do throughout the world. But how it's set up is you can't.
You
are a citizen of somewhere.
But that's not a solution. You just did a but. It's impossible. But you just said but is impossible. So, like, let me hear.
It actually is possible, but then you have to drop off from the system as a whole, and you'll never.
So let's talk about something a little bit more realistic, something a little bit more manageable that every average person could reasonably, like, take a bite out of. Like, let's talk about something that isn't so far out of reach.
I'm saying prepare yourself for things to go downhill fast.
That's not negative.
It's reality, though, because
I would argue that it isn't. That isn't just reality.
The future is not here yet.
Let me just tell you. So we've just continually been going on spending on whatever whim we need to just to keep our GDP up and to keep people happy, and we are not paying for these things. And we never will pay for these things, but on top of this expenditure, now we have to pay interest on top of this.
Now what we're doing is
putting it down in our kids for the future. So every future person born is now going to have these political debates about, we need to take more and more of your tax dollars because our government needs to spend all this.
The U.S. has never defaulted on a debt.
It's not happened. Up to this point.
Yeah, it's not going to happen either.
It's not going to happen. So what you're talking about has not happened.
Yeah, and that's and I'm saying that it's to even argue that it will happen, it's not going to happen.
What are you saying?
It's the only way. Because they always come up with a new solution. And the new solution is just a whitewash of the problem at hand. Without realizing the problem, we can't grow as a community, as a country, to actually derive to the right solutions.
No, there's no new solution. I think this was referenced pretty well in the first clip that I played. The U.S. government has not defaulted on a debt, period.
Yeah, and it won't.
And the debt is, you know, arguably pretty manageable at this point. So to say that
it's doubled in the last decade and it's not showing any signs of slowing down.
Oh, it doesn't matter.
Let me put it in context here. It's like, granted, I would have to then go back and find out how many people are under 18 years of age, but the U.S. debt right now is $54 and change per person.
That makes no sense. That's in billions, not trillions.
Oh, no, I got that. But there's like some 20 billion people, something like that, 17 billion people.
In the world.
Sorry, millions.
It's like 350
million. Like 17.8 million people in the United States. So, like, put it in context for a second. And there's like how many trillion dollars in debt again?
I'll put it. In context here, another form.
What's the number of debt? I'll do the calculator right now.
Let me just tell you this. So the average
salary
in the U.S. fiscal year is about $45,000.
How much is the debt right now?
$18 trillion.
$18 trillion?
So if you took $45,000 in 1 year of one on the average for one per American working, that would take 398 million years to pay that off at the average wage of today. So even if we all worked for 1 year and gave every penny to the government.
Oh, 317. Okay, so here's the math. So you said we've got what, like 20, how much was it? $18 trillion in debt? Is that right?
$18 trillion.
Okay, so that's the same thing as saying 18,000 divided by 317 million, right? So 18,000 divided by 317 is how much it is per person, because we're talking, you know, the trillions divided by 317 million people. So that's $56.78 per person. Like, granted, not everybody has $57 on hand, and a lot of those people are under the age of 18. But, like, when you take those factors out, it's still not like it's 20 grand per person. It's not, like, fucking outrageous. Like, it's under $100. And, like, yes, that's a lot of money to a lot of people. But, granted, there's probably some people that could afford 1,000. You know, like, it's not, like we're beyond the point of no return. So rather than focusing on all the bad decisions that all the bad people have made, let's talk about how we solve it.
I've got a
math. The numbers are off.
Let's play another clip and you can think about things a little bit.
The debt limit is a kind of financial weapon of mass destruction chained to the United States government by the United States government. Confused? Then it's time for the United States Debt Limit Explained. To understand the debt limit, you need to know the U.S. splits financial responsibility between the president and Congress. The president has two jobs when it comes to money. One, collect taxes, and two, spend those taxes to run the government. This might give you the impression that the president, with regards to money, is all-powerful, especially when you hear news reports on the president's new budget or his plan to raise taxes on haberdashers or lower taxes on apiarists. But reality is just the opposite, and the president is the one who takes orders. From whom? Congress. Congress has the jobs of setting the tax level and determining how much the government will spend by writing a budget. So while the president does get to submit budgets to Congress and asks for changes in the tax level, these are just requests that Congress doesn't have to pay attention to. Congress can add or subtract anything they want from the president's budget or throw it out entirely and write a new one. The same goes for the level of taxes. So Congress decides what it wants, bridges, tanks, buildings, courts, robots on Mars, robots on Earth, national parks, whatever, and approves a budget with that stuff in it. Once approved, the president is required by law to spend the money Congress listed in the budget and pay for it using the taxes that Congress set. As long as more taxes come in than spending goes out, everything is fine, but almost always Congress puts more stuff in the budget than they cover with taxes, which means that the president must borrow money to cover the difference. In most countries, the story ends here because if their legislatures approve more spending than they have income, they've also implicitly approved the necessary borrowing, but not in America. Here, Congress also limits the total amount of debt the United States can have. A debt limit sounds like a good idea until you see the real-world consequences of these two branches of government interacting. As the total amount borrowed gets closer to the limit, Congress usually points to the president and acts shocked that his reckless spending has brought us so close to the debt limit that they, reasonable, prudent Congress, have set. And while it's technically correct that the president has borrowed this money, Congress has forced him to do it by approving a budget that the president is legally obligated to spend without also approving the necessary taxes to cover that spending. So the debt limit fight is essentially the government version of the playground favorite, stop hitting yourself, except with added terror for everyone watching. For it's important to note that debt limit is not about future spending. It's not a credit card on which the limit will be raised so a crazy government party can be thrown. The debt limit is about paying bills already incurred. For example, the government hires a company to repave a federal highway. But if the U.S. is at the debt limit when the company asks to be paid after the work has been done, the government can't. This shakes trust in the U.S., and since large parts of the global economy depend on the dollar being trustworthy, messing with that trust is a big deal. But there is a way out. Congress can raise the debt limit, and because of the aforementioned terror, they always have. So, if not raising the debt ceiling is potentially disastrous and the solution is simple and always taken in the end, why does this debate last months? Because politics. The debt limit isn't in the Constitution, Congress created it themselves, and from their point of view, the debt limit is awesome because 1. It creates a problem that 2. Congress can technically blame on the president, who 3. Needs the solution that only they can provide. Congress gets to use the threat of mutual financial self-destruction as leverage in negotiations that they benefit from extending until the last possible second.
And Chelsea has $48,000 per American citizen, not $48.
No, you've got it wrong. Do the math again. 317 million people currently here. Do you have that statistic?
Yes. I did. 18 trillion divided by 375 million is 48,000.
Yeah, so you used your decimal points. Nope, you got your decimal points off.
No, I don't.
Think about this. I'll do it for you. So you said 18 trillion.
Yeah.
18,000 is equivalent to 317 million. So
it'd be divided by
18,000 divided by 317.
No, it's 18,000 divided by 317 would be 375
right.
billion.
You're right.
I know I'm right.
Hold on. You said, okay, so we're at 18
it's
trillion.
Chelsea,
right?
It's 48,000 per
so that's
individual. 18,
So that's 18 million divided by 317. Is that right? So there's $56,000 of debt per person, including everyone under the age of 18 and people that reasonably aren't making money.
And not even half the population works.
So like for those who are working, the national debt is like approximately like 112,000, 113,000. Like if we were going to go with that, but.
No, what it goes into the fact that I said earlier. It's 398 million years of working. And so let's just say every American works, so it'd take every American a year to pay it off, to just still, and that's that government not spending another dime.
I just keep doing this calculation over and over again, hoping that it'll change. Like, that's crazy.
It won't.
$56,000 per person alive in the country.
And that's not even the unfunded. And the unfunded is five times, if even more, like six times larger.
But isn't the unfunded, there's no real, I mean, there's no specific, I mean, there's arbitrary numbers that you can associate with that, but there's no specific.
Yeah, there is. That would be, if you go do accounting, that's what a business would have to put on under their liabilities.
Yeah, but that's okay. So you have to understand that there are like legal, you know, like rules and practices that have to be employed, but understanding what those mean is more significant. So like when you talk about unfunded liabilities, you know, so like you might have a company that's offering as part of its benefits package a pension, for example, and
yes,
they're required
pretty much what
to
the, most
accrue
of it
that
is
liability
pensions
on their balance sheet. So like, let's think about it in those terms. So like you have to accrue it. It's not due yet though. Like it might not be due for 20 years.
Yeah, and the government keeps going into further and further debt every year.
It's not an apples to oranges comparison when you talk about, you know, these unfunded liabilities. You can't just talk about them in general as though they're a current liability. You have to know more about the debt itself.
Well, yeah, that's fine, but it's still a liability out for promises
it's
that we've given to people as pensions. And
but like future money is different than money today. There is a time value to money.
Yeah,
like
we're going to be worse off every year down the road. So it's not going to get.
Oh
better.
My God, with the negativity.
Well, that's why I want to talk about this. Is why it's a specific thing. No, this is why I say you should prepare to be even being worse. This whole system is
like,
set up.
Why do you refuse
to let me talk about this?
If it can't be solved, what's the point in talking about it? That's my question. Like,
and I would disagree with you, Kirk. I think we're in an age of economic expansion and prosperity.
How so? Where's what example?
Technological expansion, intellectual expansion. The United States is a powerhouse in innovation and production.
I want to say, let me see if I can find it real quick. The population that works is indirectly or directly involved with straight from the government.
It doesn't matter. Like, those statistics don't mean anything.
Then why not just let's be a socialist country? Let's be communists.
No one.
These are the solutions that you're telling me that.
No.
Put your head in the sand.
Saying that. You are out of your mind if you think that either one of us would suggest that. That's absolutely insane.
The argument you're stating is pretty much what that argument is.
You should listen to it again.
So, Kirk.
There isn't one principle in any liberty-minded sense that would agree to let this, that this debt is fine, it has no relevance. It's a ticking time bomb for how
I
the whole. That's why I keep trying to tie in the whole system as a whole. That the government debt is just a byproduct of the system as a whole, and I kept trying to tie into everything and why that it's only going to get worse by how the direction of the world is going right now. Because the rest of the world is waking up that, you know what, America, we don't need to deal with them anymore. We don't need to trade in American dollars. We'll start trading in gold. Or anything else, or a new the SRTs or whatever they're coming out, or the Chinese Remney. It's gonna happen, and when this starts to happen,
or
our dollars
not.
Are going to hugely
depreciate value. We get it. I swear to God, we get
it. No, it's actually going to be the opposite. It's going to be hyperinflation.
That may not
to
happen.
Where our debt will be boom. That is a solution. Inflate our way out of this debt. Yeah. But then, what? How does that help our economy? And how do we live and survive? That's my point.
There might not be a hyperinflation, and there's. I mean, I'll take the devil advocate approach to this, but there is such a prevalence of deflationary instances in various economies, where even now you have money printing, you still have commodities going down in price. If you look at gas prices, oil prices, agricultural prices. Even with the money printing that's going on, and that's one of the primary concerns in central banks. So you talk about the Central Bank of China, Central Bank of Europe, the Federal Reserve. They're concerned.
You're bringing
up
manipulated commodities, though.
No, it's not.
Oil's highly manipulated right now.
Well, maybe.
Gold is manipulated. It has no relevance to the dollar.
Officially,
gold is very cheap for a dollar. For the rest of the world, their currencies and their prices of gold, is very buy opportunity right now for American dollars.
Or not.
At any rate, what solutions are available? What things can the average person do?
Buy real estate. Buy
in imaginary places.
Not in imaginary places, in real places. By tangible, you know, products that have real value. You know, I think that's, you know, that's kind of the age-old axiom, where if you want to protect, you know, as far as protecting asset value, that type of thing, that's available.
Do you mean like, are you suggesting real estate in America or just somewhere?
Well, all real estate isn't equal, right?
Right. It's not. Location, location, location is what I hear.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The solution is divesting yourself in the world market, not just in America.
And becoming sovereign.
Well, that would be my personal goal, but...
Well, diversification of risk is always key whenever you're talking about trying to preserve your, you know, wealth or the value of your savings. And so there's such a thing as market risk, and then there's systemic risk. And market risk is like, for example, like me going and putting my entire life savings in, you know, one like Apple stock or all of my savings in gold. And there's market risk because I haven't diversified myself within a market. But then when you talk about systemic risk is more so saying that all of my money is within essentially the market of the United States. Like all of my wealth is in a dollar form of one type or another. Whether it's the stock market, whether it's treasury bonds, whether it's just cash in my savings account, if it's all in the dollar, then you haven't diversified yourself and reduce the amount of systemic risk that applies to you. But what's crazy is now that we're getting into more and more of a global economy, it becomes increasingly difficult to evade the systemic risk. Because, like, even if something bad happens to the dollar, that's going to impact so many other markets as well.
On the flip side of that, there's ability to invest in emerging markets from a commodity, agricultural, industrial perspective that allows you to protect your financial interests. It's understanding. I mean, if you're going to get into the financial weeds, it's understanding various geopolitical, monetary, agricultural, areas and being able to invest in those areas to protect your assets, and that ability is there, but that's that takes you know, that takes a certain level of expertise to protect your interests. But, you know, you can either do that in a self-directed basis or, look to
an agent or something.
Well, let me ask you this, Eric. Advisor. You said that America's GDP is so strong and that we produce the most amount of goods in the world.
Yep.
It's a direct result of government intervention directly in our economy.
I would argue against that wholeheartedly. It's a direct result of the most innovative entrepreneurial system on the planet. And there has never been a more fertile environment for productivity than the United States, and it will only grow going forward.
I disagree because I think in the last two decades, all these other countries that used to be very highly controlled economies.
Even though there are issues with the American bubble, it is a bubble. Kirk, even though there are issues with the system in the United States, is it still the most entrepreneurial open market that the world's ever seen? And I think the future of the United States is very bright. And when if we talk about the debt ceiling or deficit, that, you know, rather than looking forward to a bleak financial future in the United States, I think it's very bright. That's the way I see it.
But how does that tie in?
The only way to assure failure is to prepare yourself for it. So if you're saying, I know we're going to fail, and so I just better like be able to react to the failure, instead, let's just focus on what we can do to turn it around. Let's talk about creating positive change and understanding the magnitude and the weight, the power that comes from the rest of the world.
Steal their resources, set up dictators. That's how we'll keep our system going. Screw the rest of the world.
That's outlier. That's outlier.
Anyway, what I'm trying to suggest here.
I'm saying the reality, though, is that is the situation.
As a people, we have a lot of power when we collectively work together. It's insane how much power we the people have. It's just that we were taught and trained not to believe it, and we haven't felt it for a while. But it's amazing. It's amazing what people can do when they come together.
Yeah, Chelsea, this has been out there forever. I don't know why you're just coming into it, but I've grown up with that. I've seen it all my life, and it's...
But you're saying that we're screwed, and I'm saying we're not. And
I'm saying we're not.
We are. I'm saying let's just start doing things that we think are going to promote positive change and start there. Start somewhere. I'm not going to sit down and cry about how fucked we are. I'm going to do something about it.
Am I crying about it? I'm trying to enlighten about this. What is bringing up these issues that are going to actually impact the future generations of this country? And could you imagine that our parents had set up systems that were so bad. That's why we're involved in this liberty stuff, is arguing against what the governments of our parents and our grandparents have set up. And now you guys are telling me that this system that we're in today is working?
No. I'm not arguing that that's the case. I'm arguing that there's philosophically a change afoot. And
I agree.
Yeah, the change is coming from other countries in the world right now.
No, it's not.
It is.
I disagree. No, I don't
disagree hear about
it's
that.
Look for it. It's around you.
No, I see it all over around us. But I also recognize the system that's involved around us. That once the government, if they can't, government is so. It's just like what Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama always say now that. You didn't build it. Government built it. And because that's how our government thinks today, is because government has their hands in everything.
Who gives a shit?
Everything.
Take it back. There is a way to take it back, Kirk. That's what we're saying. The tide is turning. Instead of focusing on them and asking them for permission, we're going to start doing it ourselves and stop asking them for it.
Yeah.
So they won't be able to supply because there isn't a demand. So they'll be out of jobs if we take care of it ourselves, because
And what's that going to do to our dollar? What's that going to do to the money in circulation for the rest of us? That
since our entire idea. Is that what you're saying?
The majority of the American economy is service-oriented. It's service. So that means it's all dependent on all the other businesses. So once it starts to go downhill, it's really going to go downhill far worse than ever before because we don't have the...
People, not from products. So if it's really services that we need, well, by God, we've got the people. So guess what? That's a good thing. We don't need big machines and warehouses and overhead. We need people, and we fucking got it.
That's the solution then. More people. I'm not arguing against it. I just don't see why you guys are so hostile for me just bringing up these points. It's hilarious.
I think Kirk, for me personally – I'm not being hostile, but I'm being,
I'm being more hostile. I'm poking it, but
yeah. So what I'm suggesting is that, I view a pretty bright future, you know, for the United States, and I count on ingenuity, collaboration, and, initiative. And I think the people of the United States have that in spades. And, what I've deduced or picked up from your perspective is that, everything's going to go to, shit in the next 20 years. And it's all, we got debt enslavement. It's all going downhill, that type of thing. But I honestly don't see that happening. So I think there's two diametrically opposed viewpoints.
Well, I've tried to explain myself, but you guys have never let me explain it, but that's all right.
You can explain yourself.
So, the what?
Do you want to explain yourself or no?
It's how the world is tied together and how America is the superpower right now. And we are losing that status. And that status is going to have great ramifications for our economy since we are such a service-based, debt-ridden country that the rest of the world isn't going to give a crap about us.
It doesn't really matter if they give a crap. The services, in my view, are... they are a highly regarded and sought after product. If you have an intellectual service that you can get from a provider, that's a positive. It's not necessarily a negative.
Let me ask you.
And doctors and accountants and all those people are so highly regarded because it takes the person to do that. You can't train a machine to do it. It takes the human element, which is one of the most valuable resources we have.
So let me ask you something. Why is America starting a war with Russia?
That's an entirely different conversation.
Well,
to me, it's entirely relevant because the whole system is reliant on America being the superpower and us in control of everything. And Russia's not playing our game, and a lot of countries aren't either. And they're starting to form their little communities like you're talking about, becoming friends, figuring out that, you know what, screw America.
This
trend is growing throughout the world.
Socialist, aggressive economy, and if you try to put that on the same playing field as a republic, I think you're running a fool's errand.
I'm just saying. So why is our government fearing Russia so much? If we're so sound economically, we could let Russia do whatever they want. Screw you! Don't worry about not playing part of our system, our economy. Why is it so relevant all of a sudden that we're picking the fight with Russia so bad right now? That's my point. I don't have the answer.
That's out of the context of this conversation.
My viewpoint is because so many economists state in the next 2 to 3 years we're going to have a serious depression in America here. And then inflation following it.
I think those economists are dead wrong, to be honest.
And it's funny because when you pronounce the world or when you tell people
Ron
that
Paul is one of them that agrees with me.
Sure.
Well, Ron Paul wasn't right about us being in a depression in 2012.
Depression, it instills shock and a lack of consumer confidence, which ends up being a self-fulfilling prophecy. So it's insane how much that the economy and commerce depends on things like feelings, you know, and hopes and fears. It's not a black and white science.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't want to bring kids, future generations, into this world.
But
when
they're saying that the sky is falling, people are going to freak out, and then they'll make it worse.
If the curve of our debt continues and the interest that we're going to have to pay on this debt, how can we sit here and say that our economy is going to flourish when we have to spend so much time already just to pay government taxes that don't even fit the bill in any given year? Let alone, pretty soon, we're not even going to be able to pay for the inflation or the
You don't have to sell us on this. Like, I don't believe anyone here is extremely happy about the amount of debt that we have. But I would sit here and say, no, I'm not happy about it. But instead of, like, talking about how we're ultimately doomed, let's start making positive decisions. Because I'm going to lie down and let this happen. And I believe and I have faith and I have hope that there are other people out there like me and say, I'm not just going to lay down and die. I'm going to figure out how to solve this.
Am I saying that I recommend people to lay down and die?
It's not a personal attack, Kirk. This is not about you. I'm just saying.
I didn't say about me. I said, have I been putting that out there that I think people are just going to lay down and die?
Insinuating that, Kirk. In any way, I'm stating my point
of
view.
Well, you did simulate that was my argument.
Well, you do have, Kirk, you do have a little bit of a apocalyptic view on the financial situation in the United States. Would you not disagree with that?
I think it's a house of cards.
Exactly. So I don't think she's coming
and
at you.
I'm not disagreeing that. Hey, I think, if we look at past solutions, will not be the future solutions. They always come up with new
this
solutions.
So
what I think is going on right now is that we're funneling money to other central banks in other countries to just come in and buy our bonds right now. It's not only the fact of we have a debt. That debt has to be purchased at the same time.
Well, it's
so there has to be good faith throughout the world.
It's always purchased. And it's purchased at some of the lowest interest rates that you can possibly purchase it by. The reason why it's purchased at that rate is because the United States government is really among the most trusted institutions in the world.
Yeah, but if you look at who's buying the bonds now,
The bond
market is is a key integral to our economy. Once the bond market crumbles, which is speculating that it should have happened long ago,
I would disagree with.
I just
you
told you that
happens,
one speculation out there of why people are still buying bonds is because our Federal Reserve is tapped out. They can't buy any more bonds.
They
our Social Security
as much money
fund
as they
doesn't
want.
Have cash to buy our bonds. So we have to look to China or other countries to buy our bonds. But China's not buying our bonds anymore. Japan's not buying our bonds anymore. All these other little countries are starting to buy our bonds. And where are they getting their money from? They're just helping us prop up the system. And that's why I say it's easy to see that there could be a dramatic collapse in the coming years. Because we're utilizing it's a speculation that our own government's printing money and giving it to countries to loan it back to us. So we're just here. We need to make this we need to make it look like we're still solvent, that people still want the American dollar, it's not out there. We're having to blackmail and to fund our own bond purchases is the way that it's starting to become self-evident. And when the world starts to even see that more and more, it's going to make the bond market even look even worse.
It's not self-evident. There is enough financial capital in the United States to purchase as much debt as the U.S. government will sell. And it will be sold at a low interest rate because of the fact that the U.S. government is viewed...
Would have to raise taxes to pay more
No, it's viewed as one of the most safest debt investments in the world.
No, see, all economists... say our interest rates should not be here. When America is spending everything they have, there's no savings. That's why you need higher interest rates so people save their money and don't go out there and spend it because you can, it's actually
profitable. But if they don't go out there and spend it, it contracts the economy. And then that provides a big issue.
Yeah, that's so you're just proving my point that we've worked ourselves into a system that's unsustainable.
Ah, Kirk. I'm not.
That is such a contrived thing.
I'm not disagreeing.
We broke all economic rules in the last decade.
I'm not saying that I'm happy about our debt. I'm not saying that. Let me just promise you and like say it a couple more times. I'm not happy about our debt. I didn't wake up and go, woohoo. That's not what I meant to do.
You're not saying
I don't agree with that.
Explanation on it.
I'm saying that. There is a solution, and we cannot just lay down and say there's nothing we can do. And the longer we focus on the problem instead of the solution, all that does is increase the probability that we will lose.
So what's the solution? I want to hear a solution for
Kevin. I didn't say that I had the details all mapped out. I didn't and I wouldn't because I am but one person. But I do believe that we're starting to see a movement of people that start to realize how absolutely beautifully powerful we are when we work together instead of against each other and we set aside our labels and we set aside our differences and we work together towards a common goal.
Yeah, that sounds more like socialism than liberty. Self-interest is liberty.
You're not listening close enough then, because this has absolutely nothing to do with socialism. Do you know?
No, it actually very much is. That's exactly how they say is we as a nation and we need to come together for the greater good as a whole.
Did you hear me say that? No. You're jumping to all kinds of conclusions that are extremely inappropriate and actually kind of offensive to me as a person. What I'm saying is that we are seeing communities derived out of mutual self-interest and shared values. And we can capitalize on that. And if we stop pointing fingers and we stop running to the mommy daddy government to save us, we can effectively reduce the amount of need that we have for them and then effectively reduce the size and scope of the government. But it is only through voluntary cooperation, mutual self-interest, that we can do so.
See, the monetary policy of today's theory is at all costs create assets growing in value.
Kirk.
Housing.
What was I gonna say, Eric?
Kirk, let's listen to a clip here on, I think you sent this over. U.S. Right, debt is largely fictitious.
Perfect.
Let's listen to this clip and then wrap it up.
Sounds good. I think we'll be able to interject. You might want to be ready to pause this.
Oh, you can. Yeah, either of you. Let me know. I'll pause it.
There's no question that the United States is in major debt, but the latest numbers show that the national debt of this country has surpassed $14 trillion for the first time. From June of 2010,
which was 3 years ago,
to the end of the year, the United States managed to rack up another $1 trillion to its debt. Even scarier, this country is coming extremely close to reaching its statutory ceiling of $14.3 trillion set by Congress last year. So what's going to happen next? And will Congress increase the ceiling even more? Can the United States find a way to stop borrowing? Joining me to help discuss this is professor and economist Michael Hudson from our New York studio. So, Michael, let's talk numbers. The United States government borrows $2.6 million every single minute. Congress has raised the federal debt ceiling six times in the past 3 years.
Is that a lot of money, Kirk?
What do you mean?
$2.6 million every minute?
Is what they spend? Or is that what she said?
Never mind. We'll continue.
I was thinking of something
else. But some
people
are saying that this time, with the number of Tea Party candidates that just got elected, things might be different. What's your take? Do you think Congress will vote to raise the debt ceiling yet again?
The important thing to realize is that the government doesn't really borrow. It creates money. The role of a central bank is to finance the government deficit by printing money. So the whole issue about whether the United States has a debt problem is largely fictitious. The problem the United States has is the foreign debt problem, and that's not even being discussed. When it comes to politics, I'm not part of the political discussion over whether they'll raise it or not. This becomes like a horse race. Will Congress really be crazy? What the Republicans would like to do would be to meet to do something that I think Obama would like, to cure the budget by abolishing the regulatory agencies, emptying out the FBI, stopping the Securities and Exchange Commission from regulation.
That sounds all pretty good to me. All right, or no?
More of a free market.
firing all of the central bank regulators and essentially letting the financial criminals have a free way. They'd like to cut what is really needed and use all the money they have for basically political pork giving. I don't think that's really going to happen, but the ideal is to dismember the regulatory system and essentially turn the United States into a kleptocracy, where anything goes, there's no law enforcement, there's no white-collar crime.
So, Kirk, are you really advocating anarchy? That's really sounds about, that's what it sounds about, sounds like here.
On this clip, or am I recommending what?
Well, this is your clip. I hear a lot of anarchy talk.
Well, it was more of a counter viewpoint.
Connor?
Okay. I mean, this is definitely during election time, and he's railing on the Republicans for harping on this debt and doing something more like six, just wanting to, you know, stop the growth of government, and so.
Essentially, crime is decriminalized if it's financial, white-collar crime. I think that's what the government Republicans would like to see, and it's probably what Obama would like to see. And the idea is, how can they pretend that there's really enough of a crisis to convince the people that it's necessary to abolish the white-collar police force?
Bold words. Michael, recently the chair of the White House Council of Economic Advisors, Austin Goolsbee, said this about the debt limit. Take a listen.
If we hit the debt ceiling, that's the essentially defaulting on our obligations, which is totally unprecedented in American history. The impact on the economy would be catastrophic.
How catastrophic would it be, in your opinion?
It would be like stepping on a piece of gum and having to get it off your shoe.
That's not very catastrophic, is it?
The what?
Stepping a piece of gum and getting it off your shoe?
That's quite a pain to do, actually.
Is that pretty catastrophic?
No, it was two different clips. One was catastrophic. This guy is saying, yeah, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, that's what I'm hearing. That's what I'm hearing.
Adam Smith said in The Wealth of Nations that no government has ever repaid its debt, and you can say that.
Which is interesting. When you get all in a tizzy about debt, Kirk, no government has ever repaid its debt.
Oh, I stated that earlier.
Yeah.
today. Nothing has changed. It would be a zero problem. People who talk like that are trying to frighten you, and when a...
And you should probably stop trying to frighten me.
All right, let's just stop this. I got something to...
We've got more time. It's only about a minute and a half.
It's
only a couple minutes. We're all good.
Politician tries to frighten you. You can think of what is it that he wants me to do? How am I?
What do you want us to do?
This is pure ignorance, and it's obvious that if Mr. Goolsbee knew anything about money and credit, he wouldn't have anything to do with the University of Chicago to begin with.
All right, so if these politicians can simply just continue to vote to raise the ceiling every time the debt gets close to that level, what's the point of even having it? I mean, is it just symbolic? And what are they doing to decrease the debt? It seems as if nothing is happening to stop it from getting higher. It's inevitable that the ceiling is going to have to get raised then, right?
What they want is a congressional argument over what costs to cut back. The Republicans want to essentially prevent the Consumer Protection Agency, for instance, in the Federal Reserve, from having anyone working for it. They want to prevent the Securities and Exchange Commission from having any administrators to find out who's breaking the law. They want to prevent the Environmental Protection Agency from having any inspectors to go out. So the argument over the debt limit becomes an exercise in what regulators are we going to fire first, what elements of the economy will be the first to be decriminalized. That's basically what the argument is about.
So what are the first elements of the economy that you want decriminalized, Kirk?
All of it?
All of it.
Maybe just the rule of law about not being able to harm people, private property. I think that would be a good starting point.
Furious.
But here's my point. Every America is new. It's 230 odd years now old, and America was an ideal of the world. There's a reason why there's so much talent in America, because every other country was in kind of the shape we're in today, of a controlled system, lacking freedom, lacking a growing into personal liberty and going out there and growing your own economy, your own communities, where you can go and be with like-minded people. So everyone flocked to America because of the liberty and the ideal of having communities where people can set up. And we reaped the benefits from it. Now, there are places in the world that are much more free and liberty-loving than America, is my whole point. And it's like going galt by the Ayn Rand thing. It's the system is at a point to where the best thing might just be to go galt. Is if the businesses start closing up shop and they're fed up with the taxes they have to pay, paying for politicians to go on any whim to just keep hiking up a debt that's only going to affect future generations. That's not an ideal liberty situation in the world, and especially in America. And as the world is waking up to this, the people that moved to America are realizing this, and they're starting to move out and branch to these other liberty bastions of the world that offer more economic freedom and personal freedoms. And it's a growing culture, and I don't want to see America fail. I think the basis of it is still sound, the basis of rule of law, and the future can all pan out fine, but it's the direction of the mindset of people and all things government is not good, and there's just other there's other places in the world.
We have to identify that, and we have to respect that we are seeing a change and we are seeing a movement, and it's not as, you know, forefront in the media, and it's not as sexy as like the revolution in the 60s. But it's happening, and it's very real, And I think that it deserves a little bit of credit, and I'm very hopeful to see what it brings.
Yeah, but that takes leadership and intellectual leaders.
Yeah, it's there. Yeah, I have faith in it. It's there.
Yeah. I think there's not you specifically, Kirk, but there's a lot more there than a lot of people observe. And
one way to fight these systems is to abandon it, to not feed the beast.
That's exactly what we're talking about. We're on the same.
Yeah, but that's going gulf, sure. Is what I'm saying. And that's abandoning the system. Because the system, as it gets weaker and weaker, it makes more and more drastic moves and more taking of freedoms and liberties and rights away from their citizens. We're seeing it through all this so-called terrorism in the world.
Once again, the focus on the negative. Knock it off, buddy. Like, seriously, let's look at how we can solve it instead of just drowning ourselves in all of the negative things that we see. Let's figure out how we can capitalize on and leverage what we've got.
I just gave you a remedy. There's other areas in the world that provide you more freedom and liberty and a stronger place to do business.
That doesn't solve rather what we've got going on here. And I'm not ready to just run away.
All right. And that's not going gulp then, is what I'm saying. that you just said you that
guess,
you did
I guess
like.
I'm not going gulp then.
Yeah.
I haven't given up. I'll just say that.
Yeah, I would argue we're in a pretty, if you're going to go to Bali, New Zealand, Indonesia, wherever, you're not going to find this. They're really, you stretch yourself to find a situation as open and free as what we have here. And it's only going to grow. That's maybe in me, that's the idealist, maybe in Chelsea. And I think Kirk's saying, maybe it's worth a look in a different environment where you can get out of the current state of, thought system and belief process. But
well, as a technology impact, there's far other countries that are building a stronger infrastructure than America is for technology through broadband and internet.
Again.
I would disagree with that.
Once again, that negative situation you bring up.
Why is it negative?
I'm saying, whoa.
It's an example.
Are you saying it's a good thing? Does that sound like a good thing to you? Because it doesn't sound like a good thing.
I'm glad the rest of the world is progressing.
But what I'm saying is that that tide can be turned.
Things like debt. Put money into stronger infrastructure that will benefit us long term.
We get it.
We really
do understand. We are not in disagreement here. I agree. These are not good things, but I do believe that we can do something about it.
And I think a lot of the countries that you might be thinking about, at least from a technological perspective, the United States is wide. Especially as you get in the western part of the United States, it's vast. You have wide expanses of territory where, if you look and you contrast that to densely populated areas like, Northern Europe or, South Korea or Japan, you have tightly compressed population densities that allow for, maybe better infrastructure. But when you get out into Colorado or, Utah or Nevada or Idaho, you have expansive spaces that, if you look at it, that statistically that dilutes, the comparison between the two. So you have to you have to try and keep it apples to apples. You know.
Oh, I am. You're putting words in my mouth, but you're assuming areas of the world that I'm talking about. There's plenty of large cities throughout the world that are going very high tech right now.
I'm referencing areas that are
just dying for technology businesses to come.
Yep.
And there's going to be new Silicon Valleys all over the world popping up in the next decade.
Yep.
And that's and for America, I don't want to talk about it anymore. It's the regulations that it requires and to go through to build anything in America is not business conductive or anything resulting in that large a lot of businesses want to put their money in or see their money well spent to invest in. And there's plenty of areas in the world there's just begging for investment that are willing to work with people and that
and the buy more economic freedom. Changed.
And I would agree to disagree on that assessment. But
it's fine. I didn't come to the table with a research paper to prove it. Just throwing out what I've been looking at.
All right. Should we wrap it up? You want to wrap it up, Kirk?
Yeah, hopefully we had fun tonight. It was heated at times, but it was a good time. Hopefully we made you think a little and maybe understand the debt. It's $18 trillion, and maybe you can find some inspiration to find some solutions. Let us know. Thanks, everyone.
Take care.
Good night.
Adios, mofo.